everyone, and welcome to the Risky Business Information Security Podcast. I'm Patrick Gray. This week's show is brought to you by Insomnia Security, and you might recognize this week's sponsor guest. It's our news buddy, Adam Boileau, aka Metal Storm. So Adam works for Insomnia. So this is the more metal edition this week, all metal all the time. He'll be along a little bit later on to talk about new trends in security assessments, new ways of doing things, assessments that can gauge how effective organizations are at detecting what he calls the lateral movement of attackers through networks. As you'd expect from Adam, it's very interesting stuff, and it's coming up after this week's feature interview. Speaking of which, this week's main event is an interview with Mr. H.D. Moore, creator of Metasploit and Chief Security Officer and Chief Architect at Rapid7. We're talking to him about recent attacks against the Saudi Aramco oil company that saw 30,000 of 40,000 machines on its network rendered inoperable for about 10 days, overwritten master boot record, the whole shebang. It's the single most destructive attack I think I have ever heard of, and HD will be along later to tell us what it all means. But before all of that, it's time for your first dose of metal now in the double metal edition. And here he is, it's Adam Boileau with a check of the week's news headlines. Adam, in our first news item of the week, Oracle has come under a bit of fire for failing to patch a critical issue in Java, which is now being exploited in the wild.
Yeah, there was this awful, awful bug essentially is Sandbox Escape and CodeExec in Java 1.7. And apparently, they knew about it since, what, April?
Yeah.
Something like this. And decided that they were going to patch it maybe in October. We'll see, maybe. And, of course, now this is cropped up in the wild, is being used in the wild. There's code in Metasploit. Every man and his dog is turning off Java, as they probably should have done in the first place. But, yeah, it really doesn't look good. And Oracle, haven't actually yet come out saying anything in particular that, they might patch out of band or out of cycle. It looks bad for them is the net result of all of this.
Now, one of the Sophos guys wrote to me on Twitter and wondered what we thought of the ethics of disclosing proof of concept code in such a critical bug. And I think it's a fair question. What's your thought on that?
Well, yeah, it is a fair question, I guess. On one hand, it's a traditional debate, right? On one hand, having exploit code in the wild does increase the likelihood people are getting it owned. On the other hand, having exploit code in the wild forces people to address it, and specifically in this case, Oracle, who had known about it and had decided that it wasn't important when clearly it was being used in the wild, and now it's on a much larger radar, and it probably will get fixed earlier and sooner, and less people may get owned.
I don't know. They reported it in April 2, but I don't think it was actually in the wild. It was some researchers privately alerted Oracle to this issue. But it's only popped up in the wild in the last couple of weeks. I'm asking, what do you think of the ethics of disclosing proof of concept to every man and his dog? I mean, I know it's being exploited in the wild, but what do you think of actually then making it public so that everyone can use it until that patch window closes?
Well, yeah, it's the classic full disclosure debate, and I don't know that, we've argued about this for how many years now? There's compelling arguments on both sides that having the information available really is helpful to sysadmins and people who have to, make risk decisions for enterprises, and that knowing about it is more useful than just letting the attackers know about it, which is what happened previously. It'll be, being sold on underground exploit kit markets and that sort of thing long before anyone else knows about it. So, obviously I'm on the pro full disclosure side of the debate, but, you could argue it both ways fairly convincingly, I think.
Yeah, now it seems that 6 months is a little too long to patch an issue like this. I mean, do you think Oracle deserve a bit of a spanking over this, or do you think that given the amount of QA testing involved, they might be able to be forgiven?
You can see it, right? You can see Oracle's position. QA is expensive, but it's a serious bug, right? And Java is in everybody's browsers, most people's browsers, especially in a corporate environment, and it's a doozy of a bug. I think they should have realized the severity of it, especially given how much Java is used in this kind of drive-by download and targeted phishing and stuff. Given the likelihood of exploitation, they should have patch this earlier, in my opinion.
Yeah, no. I think, look, I tend to agree that 6 months for an issue of this kind is a little bit too long. And it is worth mentioning now that Oracle has, in fact, released a patch for that bug. So CSOs out there can get cracking on fixing it up. Moving on to some other news now, and Lulzsec back in the headlines after another alleged member has been arrested in the United States and charged with offences relating to a breach at Sony Pictures Entertainment.
Yeah, so Mr. Ronaldo Rivera, age 20, of Tempe, Arizona, surrendered himself to the FBI in Phoenix, apparently. And he is apparently a neuron or royal, if you read any of the Lulzsec logs that got leaked. And yeah, he was part of the Sony breach. So he's off, presumably, to pound me in the ass once they take him through the court process. One of the other guys who pled along the same charges as being sentenced in the next few days, I believe.
Yeah, I imagine we'll start seeing sentences for a lot of this stuff coming down soon, because it's about that time, isn't it?
Well, yeah, it'll be interesting to see, you know, exactly how hard they go after these guys, because obviously, you know, Lulzsec made fun of a lot of people and, you know, made some fairly big headlines, so there's some pressure to give them the full load, but, you know, we'll see how that turns out for them.
Yeah, indeed. Now, in a feat that is probably the coolest thing to happen in hacking since Joey hacked the Gibson back in 1995, these guys have figured out how to pwn your mind.
Yeah, this is awesome. There was this set of researchers from around the place, based in, I think, Oxford, University of Berkeley, University of Geneva, and they did some research where they carried out essentially side-channel attacks on your brain. They got some off-the-shelf brain-scanning headset things.
I love that. I love that, by the way. Off-the-shelf. You know, nip down to Tandy, go to Radio Shack, you know, grab yourself some off-the-shelf brain sensors.
Yeah. So they stick these things on your skull and then get you to think about various security relevant things like a PIN number and record your brain's reaction to various stimuli, some of which include numbers. And by measuring the brain waves that you emit into this, you know, the brain scanner reader thingy, they're able to determine whether or not you have some sense of recognition with the stimulus they're showing to you. So, for example, they flashed up logos of banks to try and use that to identify which bank someone might be using, and they found that everybody knows all the logos from all the banks, so it wasn't particularly helpful. But what they were able to do was to determine plausibly what people's PIN numbers could be by showing them sequences of numbers and then registering what their brain was doing, which is, like, this is awful and cool and amazing and, you know, the distant cyberpunk future has arrived.
It's cool. You know, part of you goes, yeah, that's awesome, and then part of you goes, oh. that could be pretty bad,
right?
You know, you can see yourself strapped into some gurney in a dystopian, not too distant future, while you know, government goons flash images in front of your face while you're, you know, strapped in with your eyelids peeled open, you know, a la Clockwork Orange.
Well, exactly. Yeah, you really can see that. And of course, the more prosaic option is that the Xbox 5 will come with a, you know, brain computer interface thing that you can use to play Call of Duty 7. And then every time you say a bad word, it will check to see whether you really mean that racist insult you just screamed across the internet.
And this could open a entirely new field in biometrics, you would think.
Yeah, like, I'm going to think something really dirty and then you're going to authenticate me based on that. Yeah.
Oh, now in a slightly more happy little news item, a researcher out there, researcher in quotes, someone out there found a cross-site request forgery bug in Facebook's App Center, and Facebook have paid him $5,000, which is a pretty good little score for a CSRF, you would think.
Well, yeah, I guess, you know, it's a question of context of where you use the CSRF, and I gather, not being a Facebook user, that this was a relatively important thing. but they, so they paid the guy out $5,000, and, you know, it looked like a simple case of a developer failing to actually check the CSRF tokens. But, you know, good catch for the guy in question, and, you know, $5,000 on his, Facebook white hat credit card, it's got to be useful for something.
Exactly. And while he is using that to pay for his rent and keeping a roof over his head, he might want to prepare a tender for the US Air Force, because it is openly seeking cyber warfare operators to tender for various services and stuff. I mean, it's amazing how all of this stuff is really being dragged into the open now, isn't it?
Yeah, well, you know, it was not that long ago that all of this stuff was, as you say, very quiet and not done in the open. And to see the Air Force going out and, you know, procuring for cyberspace warfare attack capabilities, quote unquote, you know, it definitely is a sign of how much, you know, this sort of cyber mill industrial complex thing has changed the way we discuss this stuff. They're looking for the ability to, quote, destroy, deny, degrade, disrupt, deceive, corrupt, or usurp the adversary's ability to use cyberspace domain for his advantage. Which, who writes that stuff?
But like, it sounds like fun, doesn't it? Yeah. That's actually, for once, some good government copywriting. It's oh so rare.
Yeah, you know, someone in the procurement department got to have some fun with that one, yeah.
Mm. Now, the guys who call themselves Team Ghost Shell have just done a major dump because they're protesting something.
Yeah, I missed exactly what they were protesting. All I saw was, you know, bank and lab and, oh, look, SQL injection.
Yeah, so hacktivist-y stuff, down with the man. But apparently a whole bunch of records, something like a million records.
Yeah, there was a whole bunch of data in that drop, and lots of, you know, screenshots of them running SQL map and stuff, which, you know, from a technical point of view, not very exciting. But yeah, there is a bunch of data in there. And they were, interestingly enough, they were also offering access to a bunch of other systems to anyone who was, quote, up for the challenge, unquote.
I don't know how much of a challenge it is when you've got the creds, you know?
Well yeah. I mean, yeah, it does make you wonder what the criteria there is. But yeah, I mean, they're offering access to, quote, Chinese mainframes, unquote. And, you know, manufacturing systems in Japan and banks and all sorts of stuff.
Yes.
And generally causing all sorts of mayhem, dropping, you know, loot and data all over the paste bins.
It is just proof that there is some fruit out there that does indeed hang very low. It is practically scraping along the ground.
It is indeed. It's sitting there rotting right into the ground.
Now, speaking of some fruit that used to hang low, which is now hanging a little higher, Dropbox has added two-factor auth to its, you know, tremendously secure, awesome systems.
Yes, yeah, so, I mean, after they, you know, had zero factor auth previously,
they've upped it by two.
They've upped it by two, which is important. So yeah, they've added two factor auth for Dropbox, using a one time password based system, which, you know, is a good move for them, and it's a good counter to the negative publicity they got when they turned off password auth. So yeah, good move, and you know, hopefully it leads the way towards other software as a service. Kind of, you know, cloud offerings coming up with two-factor auth. It would be nice to see a standardized model, you know, whether you could have one auth application and enroll it for all your cloud apps. But, you know, I'm sure there's people who are attempting to monetize that right now.
Now, look, next up, we're going to have a bit of a chat about two bits of malware. One is called Wiper. The other one is called Gauss. Now, it's very interesting, but everyone seeks to find similarities between any bit of malware that pops up that looks vaguely interesting. People love to try to find out that, you know, there's a link between Dooku, Stuxnet, you know, Flame, that sort of stuff. But it seems like sometimes they're kind of stretching, and it is something that I've wanted to ask you about. What's your thoughts on this? First of all, there's this Wiper malware where no one has actually seen a sample, but it looks like, you know, you can see evidence of it having been there. It sort of turns up and cleans up systems. Is that kind of what Wiper does?
Well, they're certainly very clean when it's finished, yes. But yeah, the name Wiper is pretty apt. This thing does appear to do a fairly good job of deleting all sorts of things, including itself. And so, yeah, no one appears to have a sample easily available, or at least not in the in the public arena. We had a quick look around this morning, and yeah, there's just no Wipers to be found. So it's I guess that causes a bunch of challenges for attempting to do attribution. But I mean, and that's the real question, right? Is people are making these connections between these families of malware because attribution is what we want, right? And is something that has proved to be very, very difficult. At least if we can say, right, it was probably the Israelis and the US who did Stuxnet, and then the shared bits of code or shared capability or shared techniques between it and, you know, Dooku and Flame and now Gauss, then maybe we can draw some attribution lines and we can all, you know, feel guilty and bad for starting the first cyber war. But yeah, some of these...
But, you know, what does Wiper actually do? I mean, it appears to just turn up onto a computer and just, like, go buck wild, essentially nuking that system and then before removing traces of itself. So,
It's hard to say what the payloads of these malwares are when you have them, right? When it's got encrypted components and components that are only decrypted when the target system matches certain criteria, that sort of thing. Like, when you've got them, it's hard enough to figure out what they're doing and what the full set of capability is. When you don't have a copy of it, you're pretty much left with, well, it probably wipes some things and cleans up. So we really have no idea what the other payloads were, like whether it's a piece of malware that is, you know, a companion malware to other things, right? Whether it's supposed to go around after Dooku and clean up or something.
It is interesting in that it's, you know, you can only observe its behavior. You can't observe it.
Yeah, it's difficult when you don't have a sample to really say what's going on. And I'm sure that will remedy itself in the next month or so. Someone will find one somewhere.
Yeah.
Have a backup or a VM image or a snapshot or something that they can pull a sample out of. But until then, we just don't know, right? Other than the fact that it's a good name, Wiper, for something that's pretty wipey.
Now, let's move on to Gauss, because this is the one that troubles me particularly. FireEye had initially said that there was a link between Gauss and Flame because they were sharing some of the same CNC IPs. But as it turns out, these CNC IPs have been sort of sinkholed by researchers, so that was a false link. Now, Kaspersky had initially said that there were big links between Gauss and Flame in terms of architecture and maybe some code similarity. But when you read their analysis, the link doesn't really look... I mean, we spoke about Gauss a couple of weeks ago. This is the one that actually gets bank account details and stuff in Lebanon, which didn't seem like your typical spookware. And yes, there are similarities in architecture, but there's no real smoking gun to link the two. Do you agree?
Well, yeah, I guess the command and control systems was one thing that did link them, and the fact that that's now looking less likely, decreases our overall confidence in it being so. And yeah, as you say, like, it's stealing bank account numbers did seem a little weird, but I mean, maybe that's what they want you to think, right? I mean, there's always wheels within wheels around here, but yeah, I guess it's evidence of quite how difficult this attribution problem is, right? And doing it based on code samples or shared bits of code, right? There's plenty of programmers who share techniques or share libraries or even move jobs, right, and take their knowledge with them. So it's kind of hard to draw a direct organizational link just because there's some similarities in the way that they're programmed. And we saw the examples, which piece of malware was it where people were claiming it was some kind of custom compiler or custom language,
It
turned out to just be Visual C in a weird configuration. So these conclusions are always a bit shaky.
That was Kaspersky as well.
Well, I guess they're pretty itchy with the trigger finger there, aren't they?
Well, it just seems that it's like the trendy thing to do, state-sponsored when, and of course, virus writers, they might have read up on Flame and gone, gee, that looks like a really good modular architecture. I'm going to copy it,
Well, yeah. And I guess, to a certain extent, it's a self-referential process, right? You draw inferences on, the sort of things that could link malware families together, and then you decide which ones of those worked based on how well your theory fits future and past samples. So it's, self-referential, right? And we end up saying, well, because the code samples were similar or the code styles were similar between these two bits of malware, then next time we see similarities, it's probably the same bit of malware, where that may not actually be true at all, right? And this is a good example, right, of using CNC IPs as a way to link malware and saying, well, actually, this isn't reliable in this case because of these other factors. So it's, the whole attribution science is very, very fluffy at this stage. And until we actually get some concrete data, like when Obama comes out and said, hells yeah, we wrote them Stuxnets.
Well, he kind of did already, but anyway.
Well, I mean, we still haven't, he hasn't got up on a podium with a, American Eagle behind him and said, screw you Iranian jerks.
Yeah, because that'd be kind of legal. But I'm pretty confident on the attribution of that one, so I don't necessarily think it's the best example. But moving on, this story is an absolute cracker. This is PR done right. Citrix went out and commissioned a national survey by a company called Wakefield Research asking just ordinary people about cloud computing. And, some of the responses they got were just genuinely hilarious. What the survey basically found is people will pretend that they know what it is. And then you ask them questions like, can cloud computing be affected by storms? And they all go, yep.
it's in the cloud. Like, have you seen those things? They move around all over the place.
There's
like
lightning and stuff. But, some of the responses are just gold, aren't they?
Yeah, apparently the cloud is good because it lets you work, quote, in the buff, unquote. Which is an important benefit. I mean, clearly this podcast is in the cloud, so, we could not be wearing pants right now.
That is right. We are pantsless.
And that would be okay. We could, yes.
Walk us through some of the lulzier bits of this.
Apparently, 56% of people actually don't really know what a cloud is. But when pressed, people will offer an opinion. And these include such things as toilet paper, which is surprising. I didn't realize that clouds and toilet paper were immediately related in people's minds. Pillows, smoke, outer space, cyberspace, mysterious networks. Unreliable, which that's a good word to associate with the cloud. Security is another good word to perhaps associate with the cloud. Relaxed. I am relaxed when I see clouds. This is true.
Maybe relaxed security. Put them together and you got a pretty accurate picture.
Overused. I thought that was a particularly good response. A hacker's dream. Mm-hmm. Another good response there. Storage, movies, money, memory, backup, joy, innovation, drugs. Clearly someone's been shopping in the that cloudy special Silk Road store.
The dark cloud.
The dark cloud, yes. Heaven and a place to meet, which is quite nice, really.
There we go. But look, before we move on to this week's feature interview with H.D. Moore, one last thing that we wanted to draw everyone's attention to is an interesting paper that you found, which analyzes ghost rat.
Yeah, so it's an example, it's a piece of research which has been analyzing network captures of ghost rat command and control traffic and basically maps together the command and control IPs and the specific signatures of each sort of installation or each deployment of ghost rat and tries to cluster them together. And it's an interesting example of the sum of the sort of attribution work you can do. It's difficult to say that it's the be-all and end-all of attribution research, but if you're into that sort of thing, the paper is certainly worth a read. It's got some very pretty kind of cluster diagrams showing the relationships between GhostNet, botnet clients and command and control systems. And yeah, it's a good read.
Excellent, excellent, excellent. So I'll throw a link into this week's show notes for anyone out there who wants to go and have a look at that PDF. Now, Adam, we're going to come back to you after this week's feature interview for this week's sponsor interview, thanks to Insomnia Security. So it's the More Metal Edition this week, mate. So I guess, just hang tight there, buddy, and we'll be back to you presently.
Yeah, I hope people enjoy the double metal episode because it's a little creepy. It is. And people on the Twitters have been very keen to point that out.
Adam Wallow there with a look at the week's news. Up next, it is time for a chat with H.D. Moore about attacks against the Aramco oil company in Saudi Arabia. Aramco is Saudi Arabia's state-owned oil company. It is the largest oil producer in the world with the largest reserves in the world, and it has had a very bad month. On August 15, an attacker or attackers managed to gain access to the company's corporate network and hose 30,000 of the 40,000 systems attached to it. The attack meant back office staff at Aramco were stood down for 10 days while they struggled to bring everything back online. Now, Aramco claimed its production SCADA systems were isolated from the corporate network, so production was unaffected. Now, reports say the attackers used a piece of malware called Shamoon, which overwrote the master boot record of all of the affected systems with a 1,024-byte blob of data taken from an image file depicting a burning American flag. In a pastebin post, the attackers called themselves the Cutting Sword of Justice and claimed the breach was punishment for Saudi Arabia's cooperation with oppressive Middle Eastern regimes. However, some have been speculating that the attack was in fact state-sponsored and directed by Iran. Iran recently warned Saudi Arabia it should not increase its oil production to offset supply constraints caused by European and American sanctions against Iranian oil exports. Could the Cutting Sword of Justice be a group of Iranian nationalist hackers with state backing? Well, it seems every country turns to these sorts of groups when it's building its offensive online capabilities. China and Russia come to mind. Well, look, we know attribution is a difficult problem, and we don't expect to solve that problem on a podcast. But we will be asking HD for his gut feeling on whether or not he thinks this was a state-sponsored attack. But also, shouldn't nuking 30,000 boxes be difficult? Was Aramco doing a particularly shitty job at defense, or is this type of attack scenario troublingly easy? Metasploit creator and Rapid7's chief architect and CSO, H.D. Moore, joined me via Skype to discuss the attacks.
One thing you don't normally see with these types of attacks is setting up an internal machine as a proxy. The fact that they had hijacked an internal machine and had enough time to actually set that machine up to act as a gateway for the rest of the network really speaks to more to the fact that they had a lot of time to do so, less so than the sophistication of the attack. So it's something that probably took a long time to set up, and they didn't really have much risk of being caught.
So, I mean, there's been a little bit of speculation that the initial infection may have occurred via USB. Is that assertion being made on any ground? On any grounds whatsoever, or is it just a bit of a guess?
It sounds like a guess. I mean, USB is probably the least effective way to do it. Just using any one of the recent drive-by attacks would work just fine. I think for the majority of the last 5 years, there's been at least one Java exploit that'll probably work on almost every machine. So a USB attack would require physical access or emailing it or something like that, or mailing it. And it seems like that's probably the least likely scenario for how they got initial foothold.
Now, you would think, wouldn't you, that hosing 30,000 of 40,000 systems would be extremely difficult. Does it surprise you? Does the scale of this thing surprise you? Does it surprise you that they were able to infect that many systems and nuke them before anyone raised the alarm?
I mean, this, unfortunately, no. I mean, one thing you look at with most Windows networks is they typically all have the same local administrator password. I was helping out with an outbrief on an engagement that Rob 7 was on, and we were talking to the CISO, and you know, he flat out said, we can't change the passwords on these machines. That's the only way our support folks get access. It's like, well, if you don't change your passwords and they all have one, the same password, any one of your systems with, you know, any one of your users with physical access now has admin rights on your entire domain. So it wouldn't be surprising at all, especially the way this particular attack used the Windows API to leverage existing credentials or a local admin account to spread like a wildfire.
So you don't believe necessarily that these guys were doing a particularly awful job at defense?
They look like any other network we've seen. I mean, it's pretty much a standard enterprise network. If you take a look at the results in Shodan prior to the attack for their Ramco networks, what you'll see is a lot of stuff kind of sitting on the external segment that probably shouldn't be there. You see SAP interfaces exposed. You see a lot of services that, you know, may be locked down, but, you know, there could have been a little bit more control on their external network prior to this. Granted, now if you look at the network, almost nothing's online.
So what, they've pulled a whole bunch of stuff offline and they've tightened things up a little bit.
That's what it looks like. So, I mean, it's good to see that type of progress being made, but you know, there's a joke a lot of folks say in the security industry, which is that most enterprise companies either have a security team of less than 10 people or over 40 people. And you don't really have anybody in between, because what happens is most companies have fairly small teams until something really terrible happens, then they hire these gigantic teams. Yeah. So you have this huge gap on the kind of middle security team size.
Yeah, it's one way to change the org chart, isn't it?
No kidding.
So, like, if this was, you know, if you had to guess at how this attack may have unfolded, I mean, a scenario through which this could have unfolded, what, it could have been as simple as someone, say, owning a workstation through a drive-by download, using local privilege escalation vulnerabilities until they had system, obtaining the local admin password, and then what? Once they've got, you know, system-level access to one machine on the network, what did they do then?
One of the write-ups on this malware indicates that it uses the admin dollar share to propagate. So the easy way to do that is you just go to every machine in the local network neighborhood, open up the, you know, the system through SMB access, write your copy of the binary to admin dollar, and then do an SC start service on it through the SCEXE. You don't actually have to bring any other tools to the system to do this type of attack. Everything you need to propagate is built into the OS.
Yeah, that's kind of depressing, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it's the one thing. I mean, as we see more folks going towards things like whitelisting and kind of extreme malware tests, the more you can leverage the OS's built-in tools, the less chance you're going to get it detected.
But I mean, how would you have caught this? I mean, if you had reasonable defenses in place and you had that team of 40 people, what would you have been looking for to get this?
It's a little bit difficult, because in this case, only one of those machines is actually doing outbound traffic. So if you're looking at your outbound firewall logs, you're looking at, you know, outbound net flows, looking at any machine sending a lot of data, you may think, okay, one of my machines has some kind of malware on it, but it's not a big deal. It wouldn't be until you looked at your internal network logs and realized that one machine is talking to your other 30,000 desktops, that'd be obvious that there's a problem there. So most folks just don't have internal monitoring on the network that would actually be able to highlight that.
Mm. Now, if you had to guess, what would the profile of this attacker look like? Because it seems to be, you know, it's not just a kid with SQL map. It seems that there's a bit of custom code involved. How would you rate the sophistication of the attacker? Because it just doesn't smell like activists to me.
No, this looks like, to be honest, looks more like Flame, or looks like Dooku, or one of those other tools where they do a lot of work of packing binaries inside of the sections of the exe. One thing that's interesting about this malware is that it took a signed driver from a legitimate application and then repurposed that driver to access the disk in a way that you can then, you know, corrupt the drive. I think if you start looking around at all the antivirus products out there, third-party security tools, you'll find a lot of drivers that you can basically rip out of that particular product, keep the signature on that, and then abuse that to do something much more nefarious. That speaks to the exact same kind of mindset that we've seen with all these other kind of state-sponsored attacks. Whether it's a copycat or not, it does look like someone spent a lot of time building it.
So you would guess that these guys calling themselves the Cutting Sword of Justice may have had a little bit of help.
I mean, who knows whether the Cutting Sword of Justice actually exists, or whether it's a government group, or you know, my guess is it's a made up name to start with, because you don't see any references to it anywhere else. Most groups who want to, you know, make a name for themselves or cause a lot of, you know, distress or become activists are going to do a lot more to you know, push their name out there prior to an attack like this. In this case, this is the only reference you can find to it. So my guess is the name is a complete sham, and whoever's doing it doesn't want attribution.
Now, I've been reporting on InfoSec for about 11 years now, and I can't think of a single more destructive incident in that time that has been made public. Can you?
Yeah, actually.
Oh, really?
Since I think of that was worse than this, was when an antivirus vendor pushed out a bad update.
Yeah,
they managed to take out like 100,000 machines. So if anything, the AV vendors have actually been more destructive than the things they're trying to catch.
So if you want to brick a network, you can rely on McAfee and Symantec to do it for you, is what you're saying. Yes. But,
right?
But you see what I mean? Like when it comes to, you know, an adversary, I mean, we can look at very targeted cases like Stuxnet and say, you know, that had a large effect. But this, in terms of like just carnage on a network, can you think of anything else like this?
The only virus that came close to this was the what is it? Not Slammer.
What, Blaster? Or?
No, it was the one that exploited the Black Ice DLL, the Black Ice listener.
Oh, Witty.
Wittyworm. So that one actually quickly went through and slowly destroyed everyone's hard drives by overwriting the physical device. So that's the probably had a little bit higher number of targets and probably affected more machines. I think it was like 45,000 plus machines at the time. So that's the only example I can think of.
But that was, you know, 45,000 machines spread across different networks. And I believe the goal there, the scuttlebutt was it was written by a disgruntled insider who used to work for ISS, you know, who wanted to damage the ISS brand by writing a virus for its product. So it wasn't really targeting one institution, was it?
That's right. This is the first time we've seen someone attacking a single organization using kind of this type of approach for it.
So that leads me to my next question, which is, given the effectiveness of this attack against Aramco, is this something that we should be considering and worrying about?
I don't know. It's hard to tell whether this was actually effective because the company is still up and functioning. They're doing business like normal a week later. I'm sure they're going through and having to, you know, may have lost some files here and there. I think the scary thing for them is not knowing what was stolen. And I think that's really what most, you know, CISOs worry about is not, can someone destroy all my desktops? Because you can hire a consulting company to swap them out in a heartbeat. Anybody with decent disaster recovery is not going to care too much about the machines getting scorched. What they will care about is any data leaking and the ramifications of that coming out later on.
Ah, but hang on. They had to stand down a significant component of their workforce for 10 days while they this, right? So, okay, maybe 10 days you can get away with. But if these attackers decided to repeat that downtime again, say in a couple of days from now, that's going to start affecting things. I mean, I know it didn't affect their production systems, but you would think that that could almost present an existential threat to that organization if they kept getting hit in the same way.
That's a good point. We haven't seen these types of large-scale attacks to the point that people really prepare for it. I'm actually really impressed that they got back online within 10 days. But you're right, if someone repeats the same attack over time where they find different ways to get back in or, you know, continue abusing the same type of vectors, you could definitely put an organization offline near permanently this way.
See, that's the thing. Like a couple of years ago, you know, you always have the typical chat at a hacker conference over a few beers where you talk about how you would best shit up, right? So my model would be, say, a country like Australia, we have very concentrated banking sector. We've got four banks that control about 90% of the retail market share for banking. If I was an adversary of Australia, I would be establishing some access within these very large networks and just sitting there and waiting. I would also develop a Cisco O-Day. And if I wanted to really mess up this country, I would brick every Cisco router at the big four banks in one day and just knock them offline for 10 days. I mean, do you see these sorts of attacks being used more in that way? Because it just seems a remarkably logical, surgical, and effective way of damaging your adversary.
I guess I disagree that I think it's effective and that I think that it's fairly easy to recover from these kinds of attacks right now, whether you're blowing out your routers or desktops. I think, you know, the more kind of nefarious attacks when you do, you know, low-level corruption over a long period of time where by the time someone's backups are rolled around, they can't trust any one of their backups going back 6 months. I think that would probably be a much more, you know, nefarious and difficult to remove way of attacking someone's systems. But this is not subtle at all. On the router front, something I actually ran into recently is during all the SNMP scanning I was doing, of the 258,000 Cisco routers that respond to SNMP public, 18,000 of those respond to private, which means you can just take them over, rewrite the configuration, backdoor them, or shut them down. So looking at where those networks are, I mean, it's pretty easy for somebody with a couple days of, you know, Linode or another shell server access to identify a large portion of the internet routing infrastructure and shut them down in one shot.
So how would you prepare yourself from a business continuity point of view to minimize the damage? I mean, I know you keep saying that you don't think this is a particularly serious deal in terms of presenting an existential threat to the target. But I mean, if you are a CSO out there and, you know, uptime is in your brief, like what do you do if something like this happens? Is it possible to prepare for this?
we're probably going to see folks really separating the networks much further than they do today. Right now, everybody wants to be able to access Facebook while at work, or you know, check Twitter or whatnot. I think we're going to see more of those kind of, you know, private islands develop as, you know, folks finally just get fed up with it and say, you know what, our network will not be connected to anything else. And if you want to get out to anything, it's going to go through 15 different levels of, you know, review first. So I think any organization that's really paranoid about this stuff, that's really your only solution, is to go almost completely air gapped.
What about just better internal segregation to make it harder for the attacker to, you know, jump across between, you know, different business units and stuff like that? I mean, I'm surprised that they were able to actually get to 30,000 machines.
I mean, it's scary, but we see that happen all the time in the wild. We see a lot of enterprises that just have static local user accounts. What's been happening recently is a lot of folks will get rid of the local admin account and replace that by providing a domain user privileges that provides that particular domain user access to local admin on their machine. And at the same time, people screw up those policies all the time. So now that any local user has local admin on everyone's machine, so you have the same problem. So until we kind of take our existing authentication model and throw it out the window, we're not really going to be able to solve those types of problems.
So, okay, say my scenario for Aramco, which is that they were going to keep getting hit. You're not really going to need, you're not really going to need a great deal of resources, are you, to repeat this? You might need, a little bag of O'Day would get you to do this? If you've got the tools already, you can write some modular custom malware that's not going to get detected. What else do you need? Just a, you know, small bag of O'Day, and then you could keep hitting them as long as those bugs stayed good, right?
If your goal is just to delete data, you wouldn't actually need any, you know, all you need basically is to be able to run one command on one system and you'd be done. And everything would be whitelist DXEs. There would be using any third-party tools for it. It's pretty trivial to go through and delete every file of a system remotely if you have remote admin access from a session. All you need is kind of one foothold and you can keep kind of repeating these attacks indefinitely. And the only real way to solve that is to actually start doing firewalling internally. A couple of vendors sell solutions to look for things like ARP storms, look for kind of, you know, one-to-many relationships internally on internal switches to prevent these types of spreads from happening. Unfortunately, the same rules they have for detecting these kind of malware spreads also interfere with things like EPO and other types of desktop management software. So we've kind of built an entire enterprise management stack on top of the current behavior. It'd be really difficult for a lot of organizations to switch to something else.
Well, that is the problem, isn't it? Because what you've got is desktops are all managed centrally to some degree, so they need to be configurable, or they are configured in a way that makes this sort of thing possible.
That's right. I mean, I kind of look forward to the BYD thing becoming really the standard going forward. If everyone has their own personal machine, everyone's responsible for their own security to some extent, and the enterprise has to treat every machine like its own island with its own you know, individual level of access, you're going to see a lot smarter authentication controls coming out.
We've talked about that on the show before, which is, you know, BYOD is sort of driving deperimeterization, which would prevent stuff like this happening if every system on the network is regarded as hostile.
Yeah, and I don't know how else we're going to get there, and that does seem to be the direction we're going.
Now, earlier on, you said that, you know, the thing that you found most impressive about this was its use of an internal proxy server so that you didn't see these 30,000 systems all reaching out to some mysterious, you know, Russian or whatever IP through the gateway. I mean, is that really hard to set up? Or, I mean, it just seems to be quite logical, really, to set up your CNC internally.
It makes sense that it's not something you typically see. Most times a user does, you know, an attacker doesn't know what machine they're going to break into once they get inside. So therefore they don't know what IP or what host name to hard code the rest of their agents to connect back to. The fact that they're able to drop an agent on one system and then configure the binary to connect back just to that one system means they had enough time to basically set up base in one box, go back, build all their binaries, hard code the IP, then bring those binaries back into the network and then go to town on it. And that type of kind of preparation is just something you rarely see.
You know, it's funny, we're very quick to hype malware, this sort of malware in particular, in the InfoSec industry, but this is not really attracting many headlines. Does that surprise you? Because it sure as shit surprises me.
I think everyone's kind of burned out with all the Flame and Dooku and whatnot stuff lately. It's like, oh no, another malware. So it's, I think we've kind of just burned out people's attention at this point.
Yeah, but those guys didn't like scorch 30,000 boxes at the world's largest bloody oil company.
No kidding. It's definitely a first. I mean, I think it's something where for so many years, the InfoSec community is kind of taking the line that no one's going to attack, you know, no one's going to destroy my systems because it's more valuable to keep them online. And this is one of the first, you know, times we've seen a shot across the bow, saying that's not always the case.
Yeah, look, I think this is a really significant moment and a pretty big deal. I mean, do you agree with that assessment, or do you think I'm being a little bit excited?
It's going to be a wake-up call for a lot of folks who don't realize malware can be this destructive.
Rightio. Well, HD Moore, thank you very much for joining us on the show with your thoughts about the attacks against Saudi Aramco that did not at all originate from Iran.
Thanks, Patrick. My pleasure.
HD Moore there with a look at the attacks against Saudi Aramco. Now, interestingly enough, the Qatari gas giant Rasgas By the looks of things, has also been hit with a similar style of attack. Their office systems are down, and we will bring you more information on that next week. Now, I also asked some of my more interesting sources if it's plausible that a country such as Iran was using ultranationalist hackers as proxies. And my guy, let's call him Bill from Perth, he says that's entirely plausible. That sort of thing has happened in places like Russia before, conspicuously in Russia. And Iran itself has a long history of using proxies. Just think of Hezbollah. So as he put it, they've been doing it since the 79 revolution. And just because it's the internet doesn't mean they're going to do anything differently. So there you go. On to this week's sponsor segment now. And this week's show is brought to you by a fantastic security consultancy based out of New Zealand named Insomnia Security. Insomnia was founded by a bit of a security legend, Brett Moore. Brett has a long history in both vulnerability research and professional services, and he's spent the last few years building an incredibly capable team. Like, wow, wow time. One of his team members is Risky Business's own Adam Boileau. Now, Adam's full-time gig is as a consultant and pen tester for Insomnia, and if you're a regular listener, you'd know that Adam is a very clever boy. So in this week's show, Adam's going to join us in the sponsor interview as well. This is your second dose of metal in the Double Metal edition. Now, Adam wanted to come onto the show in the sponsor slot to stand up on the old soapbox and have a chat about some new approaches to security assessments. Now, many security companies, he says, are realizing they need to start offering new types of assessments that are designed to help organizations work out how good they are at detecting attackers once they're actually on the network. So really being able to quantify the quality of response that organizations have to, in a post-intrusion sort of scenario. Here's Adam.
Yeah, so I guess traditionally security has been quite vulnerability focused, right? We as security assessors, we look for vulnerabilities in people's deployments of, you know, web servers, web applications or network systems. And so all of the security assessment models are built around finding those kind of problems. And we build our networks from an architectural point of view to defend against those sort of things. And we started building strongly perimeterized networks as a response to the kind of network attacks we saw in the 90s and, you know, early 2000s, things like, you know, remote vulnerabilities in FTP servers or remote vulnerabilities in web servers. And so we built, you know, DMZ architected networks where we segregated out those systems to try and limit the impact of their compromise. And then we built an assessment methodology, around that. So if you wanted to deploy a new web application, you bring someone in, they review your the code of your web application, review your web server deployment, you know, review the firewall rules that went in and out of the web server, and we call it done. We review that kind of in a silo as one piece of kit or one deployment. And that's, you know, doesn't really reflect the way that modern attackers work. You look at Lulzsec being a great example of the way that, you know, modern attacks work. You break in through other mechanisms like social engineering or phishing or, you know, password reuse, all sorts of attacks that are outside of the scope of that kind of traditional assessment. And the net result of a lot of the ways that people break in is it's essentially you have to assume that most modern organizations that have more than, you know, 20 or 30 employees are going to be compromised, right? It's pretty much inevitable that somewhere inside a bank network there is a compromised Windows workstation. It's just the way things are. And, you know, the current way that we do assessments, I don't think really reflects that.
So what you're really talking about here is changing the way that you do assessments and operating under the assumption that the client is already owned. I mean, is that it in a nutshell?
Well, yeah, and I think it is, right? The client is owned, and the question is less don't get owned and more what are you going to do about the fact that you are? And people who came to my KiwiCon keynote, I think last year, I talked about the way we assess risk normally, right? We look at, you know, likelihood times impact. And the assertion that I made there was that the attacker controls the likelihood, i.e. they get to choose where and when to attack, and the attacker controls the impact. They get to choose what their motivation is and what they're going to do with the compromise. So you end up with the attacker controlling both of these numbers, and then you make decisions based on your interpretation of what you'd like those numbers to be, which really bears no relationship to the real world.
Now, what I'm kind of fuzzy on, I guess, with this idea is whether or not what you're proposing, you know, whether the outcome that you're proposing here is that you do this sort of assessment and figure out ways to actually secure the network, or whether or not it's more a case of identifying where problems have occurred and kicking people off the network. I mean, what is the actual outcome that people get out of this?
Yeah, so I guess what I'm proposing is that instead of looking at the identifying and preventing the methods of initial intrusion, that more we look at what sort of attackers we can detect and prevent and respond to within the organization during the post-compromise phase. And it's less about identifying who's already in there and more about giving a business, you know, some real, you know, actual metrics about their ability to be able to detect the sorts of things attackers do once they're inside the network, like during the consolidation phase or during lateral movement or during data exfiltration. And we've seen some movement in the product space. So, for example, DLP products are all the rage these days at detecting exfiltration. So having some way where we can actually quantify whether your DLP product works well in your environment, whether it does what you think it does, and if so, what sort of attackers it can detect, I think is something that we don't really do very well in the assessment space. So it would be nice to be able to say to an organization, you can detect lateral movement in the style of a script kiddie or in the style of a disgruntled insider, but you can't necessarily detect lateral movement in the style of a state-sponsored attacker. So being able to assess these kind of detection and reaction capabilities inside the perimeter in the context of the types of attackers you're likely to see, I think is something that would add some real value. And then when you can propose methods to improve detection of lateral movement or detection of exfiltration or the ability of your operations team to do rapid assessments of custom malware they find on their systems. You know, those are things that are going to make a material impact on the actual robustness of your organization against modern attackers.
Okay, so I'm about to choke on a buzzword here, but what you're really talking about is like a high-level holistic view.
Well, yeah, and this is something that that Insomnia does already, and that we, you know, quite a big bit of our business is doing red team testing, right, where we break in for real and aim for some business goal and, you know, hopefully achieve it and demonstrate what would have made our lives difficult or what would have made it less practical for us. And, you know, for most organizations, that's beyond, you know, needing that service is beyond where they are. You have to be a fairly mature organization to need that. And so trying to find a middle ground, I guess, for our customers who are, you know, realize that the limitations of project-based or external network perimeter scanning security, but aren't really ready for a full, you know, full-on red team engagement. You know, finding something in the middle that addresses the holistic, you know, problems that they have.
You said it too.
I did. I said it intentionally in response to
sure
your
you
prodding.
Sure you did, yeah.
But no, providing some actual metrics, right? So people can say, you know, this quarter we aim to be able to detect lateral movement inside a network in the style of a script kiddie.
Okay, now you keep using the term lateral movement, but maybe we should define that for the listeners.
Yeah, so I mean, during a compromise, right, there's a number of phases the attacker goes through. The first, obviously, is gaining, is doing reconnaissance. Second is gaining some kind of initial foothold in your environment. Third is consolidating that access, you know, escalating privilege on the single system, installing, you know, some kind of persistent remote access so that you can get in and out of the network. And once you've consolidated your position, then the next phase really is lateral movements, where you, you know, if you break into an organization, you have some kind of goal in mind, and it might be deface their website with a picture of Bill Gates with a pie on his face. It might be break into their control system so that you can blow up their SCADA systems and, you know, set the world on fire.
It might be
cyber war, right? Drink. It may be, you know, financially motivated. It may be IP theft. So there's some high-level target that you as an attacker have in mind, and the lateral movement phase is where you try and get there. I mean, when you break into an organization, often you know nothing about their technical implementation of their environment, but you might know that they are an energy company, but you don't know what sort of control systems they use. You don't know how the network's architected. So you go rummaging around, right? You find network documentation, you find process documentation, you find the HR systems, you find, ideally, you know, the building access control systems or something, right? So you do a bunch of internal recon. You move around the network and get yourself into whatever position you need to be in to achieve your actual goals. That's the lateral movement phase.
Now, it seems like what you're saying is that by conducting an assessment of people's ability to detect that lateral movement and then bolstering those sorts of defenses in a sort of post-compromise scenario, you reckon that this might be a good place for defenders to focus because you get, what, more bang for your buck focusing on that sort of detection? Or why focus there?
Well, because detecting, you know, zero-day attacks or preventing zero-day attacks or detecting attacks on the outside of your network is very, very complicated. Like, it's very fast-moving. If you've got network IDS signatures for last week's Windows RPC exploit, right, that's good, but you don't have signatures for next week's Windows RPC exploit. So the outside initial attack phase, you know, is very, very dynamic. But the lateral movement phase, and indeed some of the other post-compromise phases, are much less changeable. So for example, if I want to compromise most of your environment easily, really what I want is domain administrator access, or, you know, root level access on your central sign-on for Unix boxes. And so getting domain-level access, domain administrator-level access, is pretty much the same, regardless of how you got in and regardless of where you're going as an attacker. You're still going to need domain admin. And so if you can, as a defender, reliably spot new domain admin accounts, you've just spotted, you know, maybe 80% of the people who are going to be laterally moving around your network. Because, you know, domain admin's domain admin, there's a new account, you'll spot it. You know, it's a much less dynamic sort of thing to be able to identify.
And so it's companies' ability to detect things like that that you're proposing should be tested perhaps more than other areas of focus, like doing massive scans internally, looking for vulnerable services that might not be of a high consequence.
Well, ideally, I would like that capability to exist at all, because I think most organizations are not really in a position to identify the fact that there is a new domain admin account. All right, and so saying, well, we should test you for that, makes them go and think, well, actually, no, we don't even have that. Maybe we should. And that's a relatively cheap, hopefully a relatively cheap and easy thing to do, versus running Qualys scans across your, you know, 20,000 user internal network and then drowning in the 4,000 page PDF result you get out. Right, you may as well spend, you know, 5% of that money, implement a system that can detect a couple of key things, and you're in a much better place, I think.
Is it at all realistic, do you think, in a network of, say, more than 5,000 endpoints, is it at all realistic to rely on AV and regular scans, like agent with agent or without, to actually prevent those workstations getting owned? Or is there just always going to be one?
I think that history is very much on the side of that not working. Right? I mean, I don't think it works. Most of the organizations I've seen that, you know, everybody has AV, right? If you have 5,000 workstations, you have AV. Does it stop people getting owned? No, not really. It might stop them getting dumb things. You know, it might stop you getting configger. But I mean, really, that's not the main threat, right? I mean, there might be some denial of service implications getting configured, but, you know, it, AV doesn't really buy you defense against actual people, right? It buys you defense against malware, which...
But you still need it, right? I mean, you still need it, and you still need vulnerability management programs as well, don't you? But, I mean, I guess what I'm asking is, do you propose... Where would this budget come from for this type of test? Would you pull it maybe out of some of these internal scanning things, like reduce the number of licenses you're using for vulnerability scanning? I mean, where does the cash come from?
Well, I think, you know, if we take the AV example... You know, Microsoft Forefront is you know, pretty competent AV engine, right? And it's a lot cheaper than Symantec. And, you know, maybe you're better off, you know, not paying Symantec six figures and using Forefront, right? And take the budget, you know, that and do something else with it. I think that, you know, we understand, you know, things like AV and you know, continuous vulnerability assessment on the perimeter and, you know, desktop management, patch management things. Those things really shouldn't be expensive and difficult, right? Shouldn't cost you a lot of money. You know, maybe when you first deployed them 5 years ago, they were new and expensive. But perhaps these days you can find a way to streamline these sort of things. Like maybe you need less fancy third-party patch management now because the Microsoft tools have improved and, you know, Adobe has auto-patching. You know, maybe you don't need to buy Alteris or something.
Yeah, look, I have been wondering myself how long it's going to be before people start switching to the simpler tools for getting some of these basic security functions accomplished. Adam, thank you so much for joining us again as part of the More Metal edition. Thanks again to Insomnia. And, mate, we're going to chat to you again next week in the news.
I'll look forward to it. Hopefully, I won't have to, hopefully, I'll be able to badmouth the sponsor next week.
Prettier than that butterfly, I'll watch you head off through this night sky. The thought of you lingers like the smoke that's drifting from my fingers. Well, I said I see there's a tree outside my room, my face reflected in the
past. Adam Boileau, again, with this week's sponsor interview in the Double Metal edition. Thanks again to Insomnia Security and to Adam. And, you know, Insomnia, great guys. They do some extremely interesting work, so go check them out. And that's it for this week's show. Another episode down, Ep 252, done. Now, this is We're Up To Our Necks In It. It's by Skunk Hour. Get it on iTunes. See you next week.
Strip my flesh back bare to the wind that violates my skin.
Washing away under the sun, vanish in the street heat, melting on top, lost in a wave of cutthroat up and values, looking for some, getting too few.
fed to the urban beast. Cold as a concrete web. Your privilege just out of reach.
We're up to our necks in it. We're up to our necks in it.
Walking the streets of this big, shitty, gritty city on a day when I feel like I'm living too close to the big electric light bulb in the sky. Shy. The ratted wings mingle about my feet. When I come to meet a man, a forsaken man. He is alone, he has no home, no family here. No brother, no mother, no sister, no other. He cries to me, he is tired. Where does he send his message? To what, to whom, to why, to where does he send it? What force is going to mend it? If we wish we could help this man, our backs would not break. But hypocrisy only leaves us constantly bending. He wishes to end it.
The progress that eats the soul of the past. Demolished, lost, rebuilt, dehumanized, regimented. One nine to five's the doctrine. Give me the sky right behind the grave. Buildings framed in a sunset. I'm sliding. Holy.
Fed to the urban beast. We are pumped through collapsing veins. And so fast, we barely speak.
We're up to our necks in it. We're up to our necks in it.
Next day.